Hi, I'm with Nina Joy Lawrence. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Serge.
So we're going to talk about your experience with the Afghanistan Focusing Project. Do you want to give a few words of background about this project?
Thanks, yeah. Both Patricia, Dr. Patricia Amedian and I ended up in Pakistan just for other reasons on Fulbright Fellowship and got to know each other well enough, and she stayed and I went home with my husband, who was the one who had the Fulbright. Anyway, we came back a couple years later in 2000, and she was working for an Afghan aid organization at that time, coordination of humanitarian assistance, and they were all refugees trying to help people inside Afghanistan not have to become refugees, and they were under a great deal of stress. And the head of that organization asked Pat to find some help for his team, his work team, to help them with the amount of stress they were under. And she asked me, since I was a counselor, did I have any skills that, or did I have something that we could use with them? And I thought maybe focusing.
Oh.
And that's how we got into that. And then when they got to go back after 9/11 to Afghanistan, they invited us.
Okay, so it started with an idea of helping refugees with a form of counseling that would be adapted to them. And how did you manage to introduce focusing to people who obviously had no framework for such a thing?
Right. Well, I used a poem, and in fact, we didn't use any other counseling skills, and I still was kind of thinking of it as counseling at the time, but I had a poem by Jalaluddin Balkhi, who's known as Rumi, the guest house poem, and that refers to this being human as a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, and they come in and you welcome them. And it sounded to me kind of like focusing. I didn't actually know at the time, but I very shortly found out that Rumi was born in the Balkh province of Afghanistan. So immediately they said, he's ours and this is our stuff. And they immediately decided that it was, you know, it wasn't Western, it wasn't something from somewhere else that somebody was trying to teach them. It was theirs, and they could use it. And they started to be very interested.
So from the beginning, you didn't describe it as a Western method of mental health, but you described, you used that poem of Rumi to talk about the movement of feelings inside the mind.
Not so much inside the mind, inside the being.
Inside the being.
The human body. This, in fact, the original translation is even more body than this being human as a guest house. They told me Farsi words are this human body.
Wow.
Is a guest house. So it's very bodily appropriate for noticing inside the body, and it helps very much. So, yeah.
So, you know, just I want to comment on this, that we're talking about focusing, but what's really interesting in your experience of bringing focusing to this different culture, this different people, what you found is something where there was already a predisposition, a metaphor, a cultural experience of the human body as a guest house for feelings, and you built on it instead of presenting it as a mental health method.
Yeah, we actually did do that, build on it. I mean, I didn't know yet. I hadn't learned a whole lot of focusing at the time. We just jumped in with what we had and and the poem, and I still didn't know how to sort of help a group really do this in a community mental health way, but we just used this local metaphor and started work. And they, after the first weekend, or no, it wasn't, yeah, after the first workshop, the head of CHA said to me that he was very sad. And I, of course, well, he said to the whole group that how sad he was, and people, and I was wondering, well, can you tell me more about that? And he said, think of where we would be if we had paid attention to our own, if we'd been doing this, if we had paid attention to our own poet, you know, for the last 800 years, where would the world be different than it is now? Not just us, the whole world. You know?
Yeah.
And he was very sad that that didn't happen, but he was also really, really seeing the power of a focusing approach.
So how did you actually teach it? What happened? How was, you know, I assume it evolved over time. What's...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, we taught it as in a... We'd sit in a circle and on the floor, because that's how you sit. And I used a lot of the methods that I learned from Ann Weiser Cornell. We had little cards to look at, and people tried focusing. And but it wasn't just the way... I mean, I did a lot of adapting, like the poem, and we used art, and we used... other group methods like little games and things to get people loosened up. The people who come to a workshop in Afghanistan haven't been able to read about it in the newspaper and come, or hear about it from a friend and sign up or something. They happen to be assigned by their boss. Go and learn this thing. I need you to learn this thing. It's part of your job. Mm-hmm. And so here we are with a bunch of people that have no clue about focusing, and they're told they have to learn this, and they might be a computer technician or a cameraman for the TV station or a statistics person or an office secretary or something. And they, I mean, everybody in this non-governmental organization, all the lead people were just assigned. You need to learn this. Or you might be a doctor or a nurse. Anyway. And so we had to right away make allowances for things like that. Well, if people felt like they didn't want to, then we had to give them that permission, you know. If you don't want to learn this, you just take a little journey in your mind somewhere else and enjoy sitting here and having time off work, because we needed to make it really voluntary, and that was the only way to do it. So we actually, lots of people really, I mean, there were people that we didn't think were tuning in, but most people really grabbed and wanted what we gave. We found out, you know, like a year later, Patricia had an example. She had taught a group of women in another organization a year before, just a half a day's workshop. And then I went back to teach another level in the next year. And one of the people that she thought had gotten nothing, absolutely nothing, and had zonked out in the corner, had slept in the corner or something, I don't know, maybe not that much, but had seemed really uninvolved, came up to me at the beginning of the workshop and said that this workshop last year changed my whole life. Mm. And she gave me several examples of how she had been unable to sleep and had been worried all the time about something, and then being able to listen to her guests inside had totally changed her life. So just from a little bit, people seem to have big shifts and big changes.
Mm. Yeah, so in a way, what maybe this person's case demonstrates is that people got into the spirit of it, the sense of it, and were able to build on it.
Yes, yes. And we would start out in the workshops. Mostly the first thing we do is give little pieces that they can use right away and take home and try that night in their families or in their communities. And one of the pieces we give is, well, particularly in Afghanistan, people don't feel safe, you know, and they don't feel safe in their bodies. And so going inside and listening to something is not a safe thing to do right away. So the very first thing we do is the safe place exercise, which I guess is pretty common in therapeutic techniques in the world. But we have people imagine going inside, imagine a lovely place that feels calm and safe to them. And then we do a body scan and they take that in and inside themselves and sit in that in their imaginations and see how that feels in their body. And they love it. Mm-hmm. And it relaxes them and they often just take that home and do that with themselves or with their kids or something to get everybody all relaxed and feeling safe and calm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the next kind of thing we have them do is to learn how to listen to each other without any focusing involved, just listening, just somebody, or we talk about what makes excellent listening, what makes really wonderful listening, and then we practice that, and it is essentially learning how to be present, be with another person, and without judgment, without goals, mm-hmm. without bias, without taking sides in that person even. Like, if the listener takes sides, oh, you know, yes, I know, we really do like this part of you better than that part of you, that doesn't make for safety. And the group comes up with all these things, and we make sure there are several in there that are pretty helpful. But then then they listen to each other while somebody tells a story. I mean, while one of them tells a story to the other, and they listen in this new way, and then they go home and practice listening. And then they're ready to listen in this way to somebody who is going inside and finding a guest. And it's not just the feelings. I'm kind of running on. Is this okay, Serge?
Yeah. That's
okay.
No, that's perfect. You give a very nice step-by-step sense of how that whole experience of focusing is transmitted.
Okay, yeah. So after the learning, the listening, then we talk to them about, well, what is this inner guest place? What do we mean? It's not just, we don't try to say it's not a feeling. It might come that way first. But it's the whole, how our bodies feel about the whole situation. And we use Jean Genlin's wonderful little example of somebody knocking at the door. And you go to open the door and it's somebody you just are so happy to see. How does that feel? How does that whole situation feel in your body?
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to say. And then going back in and noticing how they feel inside if somebody comes to the door who they really don't want to see. And they say that in the group. And the added wonderfulness, how it works in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. is that it's a hospitality culture. It's one of the most most I don't know how to say it, intensely hospitality cultures in the world.
Mm.
And somebody comes to your door and you like them, you sit them, we ask the group, okay, what do you do then? Oh, we bring them in, we sit them down, they put their shoes off at the door, of course, because you walk on the rugs with not shoes on. Anyway, they come in, they take off their shoes, they sit on the floor, in our guest house, our guest room in the house, every house has a guest place for guests to sit. And we bring them tea and we serve them something to eat and we listen to them and we listen and find out why they, why they came and we might hide their shoes if we really don't want them to go because, we really, really like them. And then when you do the other part of the example, and what do you do now that you have this guest and you have said how it feels inside when that guest comes in the door? Well, and they say things like, oh, and I'm twisting in, or I feel like I'm backing up, or I get all stiff in front. They're giving us body descriptions of how it feels at first, and then they say, what do I do? Well, I take a big breath and I invite them in and I sit them down and they leave their shoes at the door and I feed them tea and I listen to them, but I don't hide their shoes. And the reason I say that is because there is still this hospitality around the guest, whether one likes it or not. So that means that people there have a head start in not getting identified with their inner felt sense or the emotions around the felt sense, because they are used to being hospitable to people whether they like them or not.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is an inner guest, you just treat it like that too. Oh, and you don't automatically get, take sides and want to get rid of it. And I mean, they know that something in them doesn't like the guest, but it's really easier for them right off the bat not to get identified because they're used to treating each guest honorably.
Yeah. So just to paraphrase a little bit what you said, what you found very helpful is two metaphors that existed in the culture. One is that very hospitality-prone culture where you will put a very high value on welcoming guests, whether you like them or not, and being a good host to any guest. And two is the poetic metaphor in Rumi of feelings, sensations, being like guests in the guest house of the mind body. And go.
Yes, and in fact, Rumi, coming from that culture, actually put them together in the same poem. That poem has, be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Welcome and entertain them all. It's got both that this body is a guest house and what comes and goes is a guest, and we treat them in this hospitality way.
Right.
So it's both those metaphors are in that poem.
And so the experience is that cultural metaphor is going to help transmit the experience of focusing by finding something that culturally works, that people can relate to. It's going to be much easier to explain focusing than to import it as a technique that's superimposed to whatever you do and whoever you are.
Yes, that's what we're finding. And because focusing is a human thing, not a Western thing or whatever, Eugene Genlin, of course, saw it happening. He didn't make it up. we can, in our experience anyway, we can find something that pertains to doing, to, in a culture that pertains to doing something like that or that can contain that, in most anywhere, you'd find something you could use that would point to some part of focusing or something like focusing so that you could, use it to teach.
So I would like to maybe suggest to people who are listening to this conversation that, while when we talk about Afghanistan and Rumi, there's something very exotic about it and a sense of a need for metaphors, that maybe talking about focusing to engineers or dentists or firemen or marine biologists or whatever other profession may be a similar challenge, that it's a question of finding a cultural metaphor in that particular culture to introduce the concept of focusing instead of shoehorning it as something that's foreign.
Yes, one part of what we did in New York at a workshop this last summer was to invite people to find cultural metaphors for where they are. And people came up with things like some Japanese people were talking about, well, there's something familiar about the tea ceremony and focusing, it feels like it goes together. And there were people from New York that were saying, it could be kind of like a place where a bunch of jazz musicians gather together and you don't know who's going to show up, and they bring their instruments and they play this internal music, they play this music, and it's like you could listen inside as if you were listening to this jam session. Of whatever. So that there's lots of people found metaphors that really worked.
Great.
For their own places. Yeah.
And another thing that struck me as you were describing what you were doing in Afghanistan is how you were doing the teaching by, in a way, skill levels, teaching people a sense of feeling safe, then teaching people how to listen to a story, then listen while somebody finds a guest, and so on and so forth. So they don't really need to say, oh, this is focusing, it's a big thing, but basically reinforcing step by step a few skills that are going to help them get a whole experience of focusing.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. And I tried this out again here because I have not been teaching the way I here in the U.S. the way I teach in Afghanistan, and finally I made the shift. And this last weekend I was teaching to a group in Oregon, and I used this way, and it really worked. It was to give these little distinct skills that they could take immediately and use independently. Like you can use that listening without anything more. And then you can use the listening the neatest thing was that the inside finding a guest after we'd done that exercise that Jean talks, the guest coming to the door exercise, I said, well, how might you use this? And we talked about you can stop in the middle of whatever you're doing if you notice something is knocking on your door, mm-hmm. or text messaging you from inside or something like that, to another cultural metaphor.
Yes.
You can get this little uneasy buzzy, ooh, something's wrong here. And it's like a text message in your pocket, coming into your cell phone. Bzz, bzz. Oh, what's here? There's some guest inside me. There's something in me that is worried about something right now. Hello. And then you have to go on with what you're doing maybe, but at least you've said hello and it changes how it is in you,
mm-hmm.
that you know it's there. and it changes how you go forward the next minute. And it's like, it's kind of like, and I also talked about the Mary Hendricks Jenlin's revolutionary pause sort of feel. You know, you can be going along and somebody is asking you to make a decision. You can say, I need a minute. And you can check, just that little checking inside. To, in the same way as you go to the door and you open the door and there's a guest and suddenly you know what it feels like, you can pause and say, just a minute, and you can check your door or your inner text message or something. What's going on in here right now? Oh, okay. And so they could use it in their life right away instead of learning the whole thing of focusing. Each piece I gave them, they could use it immediately.
Right. So in other words, you're identifying a whole wide, fuzzy areas of something about checking inside, having this connection inside, this listening, and this whole fuzzy group of skills is something that you can enter from any part without thinking of, you have this very clearly defined thing that's called focusing that you have to administer to people in its perfect way. But you're just, you know, welcoming them to this fuzzy world and letting them navigate their way in it and progress into it.
I love that way of saying it. Thank you, Serge. Yeah, that really feels right when I check what you just said.
Mm.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. And we do get down to actual, you know, okay, this is how you do the focusing part, and you can use that this way when you have a decision or when you have, and so they just start out, you know. The first, these people had 5 hours of workshop, and by the time they were done, they had about 4 skills that they could go take and use or more, right, you know, that night and the next day, and including focusing with a partner. The partner would have to just listen in quiet, that nice, wonderful listening.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't taught any reflecting. But what we do teach is that the focuser, like the way Anne teaches, the focuser really is responsible. It isn't therapy, it's community wellness. And so the focuser is responsible for listening to their guests, and the listener is not responsible except for being with them in this kind listening way, is not responsible for trying to help them get somewhere or listen particularly, be good at reflecting or anything right away. It's just this listening, and it's so powerful that, you know, some people decide they don't want anything but that.
So it's very interesting that the project in Afghanistan started with a concept of refugees needing mental health or some form related to mental health. And you ended up with a model of community wellness, not therapy, where the listeners were not therapists, were, you know, facilitators, listeners, and the responsibility being clearly in the camp of the focuser, and mm-hmm. and it worked.
Oh yeah, it definitely works very, very well. Yeah. Oh, and one thing that about Afghanistan is they don't like the partner thing that much, and we didn't know how to deal with that for a long time. They don't have anything. They don't have confidentiality. If they say something to somebody, it's going to go somewhere. Mm. You know, it's, they don't, either that or it's a complete family secret and nobody in the family is going to tell anybody because it would cause all kinds of havoc somewhere or something. But, so we were wondering, well, how do we do it there? And what they seem to have evolved and shown us is that they like it that somebody will lead the group so that it is still the focuser's responsibility as far as what they do inside, but one of them will lead the group in a guided session, like, okay, notice your hands and body and feet and sitting there, and I'll lead them through a kind of body scan, and then we'll invite them to notice any guests, and we'll leave some space and let them talk with their guests. And they do this something. They are with their guests, listening inside into what's going on in their whole being about their lives right now. and then the person who's guiding will after a while bring them back to the room, and then they'll have a group sharing, which may or may not include very much personal stuff. But it's not in pairs usually.
Mm.
So they may take it and do it in pairs at home with a family member or something, but they're not big on pairs.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting that whole approach to making using the culture and the situation at hand in order to adapt the experience to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So. Nina, as we're coming to the end, I just want to see if there's something you would want to say as a conclusion to this conversation, obviously hoping that in the future we'll have more.
I continue to be very sort of energized by this whole community wellness focusing idea, and sort of daily, weekly, finding something new and having, so it's more, the journey is more like taking a step in front of us and then another step with the clarity that we have at that time, and certainly not jumping all the way around the world to do something that we've thought up in our heads. It's really the step by step in front of us. And in fact, it feels a lot to us, both Pat and I, like Tolkien's Bilbo stepping out the door of his hobbit hole and singing about getting swept off on the road. The road goes ever on and you don't know where you're going. Mm. You step out and away you go.
What strikes me as you say that is I have this sense of the person walking on the road, but with a focusing attitude of taking in, observing what it is, being mindful of what's happening, who is in front of you, taking in that person and having a focusing, inspired conversation with that person instead of just force-feeding a technique.
Yes, very much so, yeah. So that each, oh, and that's the thing. That's the wonderful thing. Each connection about focusing is a collaboration, not a me to you teaching something down or something. It's a collaboration. It's how is it going to work here? I can bring something, but you bring something, or we both bring something. And how's this going to work? And let's find out together.
Mm.
And we say that. I say that particularly. I say that to people. I don't know. I've never done this before. I've never worked with you in this group before. You know,
mm-hmm.
How's this going to work? I don't know.
Wow. Yeah.
What you bring is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And people do get involved right away. They start feeling like, oh, I could use it this way, or how about this? Does this fit in here? And they understand that it is them too. It's not just I know it and they don't and I'm teaching it.
Right. Because in effect, the two people are collaborating, as you said, in discovering that unique method, that unique approach to focusing that's going to work for this person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Hmm. Well, thanks, Nina.
Mm-hmm. Very well. Thank you for including me in this project. I like it.
Mm-hmm. This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.